Hi, this is Helen Klein Ross on January 24th, 2024, interviewing Jean McMillan in her home on Chatfield Drive in Lakeville, Connecticut. Jean, I am so happy to be able to talk with you this morning. And even though we've talked a little bit about how you came to be here, I'd really like to know when you came here to Salisbury. I assume you're not from here originally.
No, I'm not.
And why you came.
I have always wanted to be a teacher. And when I graduated, I needed a job. And I had a job in East Longmeadow, Massachusetts. I'd signed a contract. And my mother got a letter from the principal of Salisbury Central School. He really wanted me to come for an interview. And my mother said, but she's got a job. Well, have her come down for an interview. Even if she doesn't come to us this year, I would like her for next year. So my father brought me down, and the interview was from 9:30 in the morning until 1 o'clock.
Wow.
And I said,
what could they possibly have
asked? He wanted to know everything. And I said, you know, my father's sitting in the car, and we would really like to have something to eat. Oh, he says, I'm so sorry. So we had lunch at school. And then he said, now, this is your job if you want it. This is the room you're going to have. Go over to the superintendent of schools, and he'll approve it. So I went over to the high school, and he approved it. And then I went back and said, all right, I've got a contract. How do I? Oh, he says, don't worry about that. We'll break contracts so that you can come here.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow.
So that's how I wound up at Salisbury Central. And I came down to get an apartment because I needed someplace to live. And I'd seen an ad in the Lakeville Journal for the Holly Block, which was an extant at that time. And I went into the post office to ask about where it was and so forth. And Dick Barton was on the window, and I asked him, and he said, why are you coming to Salisbury? And I said, I'm going to be a teacher at Salisbury Central. I don't think you'd like the Holly Block, but let me call Jimmy Vale because he may have an apartment available. So that's how I wound up at Jimmy Vale's apartment house, which is the corner of Main Street and Lincoln City Road.
Oh, and why did he think you wouldn't like the Holly Block? What was the Holly Block
then? A little bit like a red light district. And that wouldn't morally have been a good idea for a teacher.
How many apartments were in there?
Seven.
But it was also stores?
Oh, the Holly Block? About seven. Stores on the main level. And then there were two other levels of apartments. Mary Louise Gentile Dios Matos describes it very accurately because she lived there when she was a child.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And that building was raised?
Yes, it was raised about, you know, maybe 69, 70-ish, because I do remember it, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's why I came to Salisbury Central. It's the only job I ever had. Loved it.
And so you, unlike many young women who kind of fall into teaching, this was something you knew that you wanted to do.
Always.
Because
you always
went to a college that specialized in elementary
Cuba
education.
Cuba College at that time was a woman's college, 800 women, specialized in nursing and elementary education.
And where is it located?
Finger Lakes region of New York State, Cuca Park, New York.
Oh.
And when I graduated, my class was the last class, 1967, to get permanent certification to teach elementary education K through 6 in New York State. And I still have my permanent certification.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard that they just honored you.
Oh, they did. I got a letter from CUCA in March of 2023 saying that I'd been nominated for effective use of retirement, which I love. And I couldn't figure out who the heck would nominate me because I'm in touch with one of my colleagues from school, but she wouldn't have been involved in the school that much. And I thought it was a joke because I got the letter April 1st. And I emailed one of the people that I knew at the college, and I said, you know, is this for real? Oh, yes, fill out the application. All right, so I filled it out. And for consideration of this award, please complete the enclosed form and return it by May 1st to Laurie Adams. So I filled out the form, and they wanted to know just about anything that I'd ever done as a volunteer. And I had about 4 pages worth of gobbledygook that I had done. I babysat at the Tremaine Gallery, and I'd worked after school, the SOAR program and extras. I had docented for several years at the Holly Williams House. I had worked as the town historian for, at that point, 9 years. I had worked on oral history, which is a separate project, for 13 years. And the original letter said, if you don't hear by the 15th of June, we'll save your material. Well, I didn't get a letter by the 15th of June, so I put it in my file. And then about the 1st of July, I got a letter that said, congratulations! I'm so happy to inform you that your application was selected for the effective use of retirement. In reviewing your submission, we were impressed with the depth and breadth of your experiences and your clear love of our alma mater.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And what I received was a framed picture of the college, and it says effective use of retirement. I was the oldest recipient. I didn't go out to the dinner and all that hoopla, but one of the reps from the alumni relations came to visit in September, and she brought me the award.
Oh, nice.
And I said to Billy Joe, do you know who honored me, who nominated me? And she said, I did. And I said, why? You've only seen me a couple of times. Well, she said, you talk so passionately about the oral history, and I think it was such a valuable program that I nominated you.
That's fantastic.
Which was a great surprise. So that was, it truly, to me, was very much of an honor, because it was the oral history program itself that was being honored, not, well, we'll give Jean an award because she's a nice girl.
Yeah.
You know, that meant a lot to me.
Clearly, yeah.
And I'm very fond of my college. So.
And I'm sure it's inspirational to other students who are there now to know, you know, to know what people have done with their education.
Well, I hope so, but they no longer give the elementary education degree, and they went to co-educational.
Oh.
So, but it's still a good school.
Well, talking about times changing, I want to ask you about when you came to Salisbury Central. You lived in a rental.
I lived in an apartment.
Mm-hmm. Rental. But I understand you bought a house, or you... Then
no.
What?
No.
Okay.
I lived in the apartment for 4 years, and there was a discrepancy between my landlady and myself, and so I left. But I didn't have a place to stay. So some of the teachers that I worked with said, well, why don't you rent a room from Al Eggleston, who was a former principal of Salisbury Central School, who was a real iron lady. So I rented from her for a year. And then in May, when she came back from Florida, because I was house sitting, she said, well, we've got to find you another apartment. So I wound up over on Wells Hill Road, which was fine. And after being there for 3 or 4 years, Mrs. Sisson came to me and she says, my father has died and my mother would like to come and live with me, and we need your apartment. And it was, ooh. Well, in 1974, I decided that I wanted to build a house. So I had to buy a piece of property, because I'd been looking at houses in the area with various realtors. There was nothing I could afford on the salary that I was making at the time. So I looked at land, and I bought plot 18 on the Chatfield Hills Division. I had money for a down payment, but I needed a mortgage. And the mortgage was with Litchfield Bank and Trust for $3,000, and my father had to sign surety for me.
Your father had to sign?
My father had to sign. I was a single woman. Even though I was vested in school, I taught at least 7 years, they wouldn't accept my signature loan. My father had to sign for me. Okay. And we flash forward to Mrs. Sisson saying that she needed my apartment. So I called up my contractor and I said, guess what? We're going to build a year early. I had had him look at the land when I bought it to make sure that he could build on it because it's a ski slope. And he says, all right. So I had to get a construction mortgage, which is a little more difficult than just this regular mortgage. Well, I went to several different banks, and I went up to Great Barrington, to the Great Barrington Savings Bank, and I think the lady was a Mrs. Majewski. I went into her office, and I explained what I wanted, and she said, are you the daughter of Chester Porter? And I said, yes, and she says, are you the Jean Porter that gave back the Rotary Scholarship when you left school? And I said, yes, you have your mortgage.
Tell us that story.
I graduated from Searles High School in 63, and I was third in my class. And I was supposed to get the Rotary Scholarship, which was $250. The fellow that the president, Mr. Moran, had wanted to give me the money. A week before we graduated, the valedictorian's father died very unexpectedly. And the Rotary Club gave Patty Lang the money. They should have. She needed it. And Mr. Moran was so upset because he promised me, and he said, look, if we have any money left over from the horse show, we'll give you that. The Rotary Club in Great Barrington always did a horse show in July. You know, big deal. I got $250 from the Rotary Club. It wasn't their scholarship. It was an out and right gift. But I felt like with the DAR scholarship and some of the other scholarships that I got from a senior in high school, I wanted to give it back. So when I graduated in 67, I wrote a letter to the Rotary Club and I gave them a check for $150. And they made a big fuss over it. It was on the radio and the school board was impressed. And, you know, it's what you do. You give back. And that was it. You know, that was 67. And I'm going in for a mortgage in 77? The very fact that they remembered, it was very nice. It was very great. I couldn't do that today. No way I could get it. And at that point, the mortgage rate was 8.5%.
No kidding.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
So we started building June 4th, 1978, and I was in the house October 24th, 1978. 3 months.
You're kidding. An entire house?
Yep. This is a stick-built house. It's not a prefab like across the street. This is a stick-built house.
What does stick-built mean?
It's from the ground up. It's
in
not prefabricated.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's astounding.
The contractor that I worked with was Warren and Mackey from Sheffield, and they were the best in Berkshire County. Mr. Warren had worked with my parents. They redid my mother's kitchen. And so I knew Mr. Warren. I was 32 at the time, and he treated me like his daughter. And he'd say, now, Jean, I want you to go out and learn about heating systems to decide what you want to do. Do you want electric heat? Do you want oil heat? Do you want forced hot water? Do you want forced hot air? You have to make the decision. And this was very different because a lot of times they just assume that you don't know anything and this is what we're going to do. I was not treated that way. I had worked with him on designing the house, and it was interesting. I took a course from LaSalle College in Chicago, interior decorating, so that I knew about reading plans. And
so you went to Chicago?
No, it was a correspondence course.
Oh, I see.
Correspondence course. so that I knew about traffic patterns and lighting and colors that would make the house look bigger, or if I painted the ceiling black, it would make the room look smaller, that sort of thing. Because I wanted to do it right the first time.
Yeah.
And it worked out beautifully.
So you moved in 3 months later.
Yes.
That's amazing.
I didn't have to sign for the, my dad didn't have to sign for the construction mortgage, but there were glitches because I was a single woman. You have to put a $500 bond to the town hall and have an asphalt entry into your driveway. And I did that. I gave the bond in and so forth, and I got a call at school from Charlotte Reed saying, Jean, you're going to lose your bond because they didn't do the entryway right. So I called Mr. Warren, and he talked to the contractor, and the contractor says, oh, well, she was just a woman. I thought I could get away with it. Then I wanted to move my furniture in, which had been in storage, and I went to my principal, and I explained the situation, and he said, no, you may not have a personal day for that, and if you do take a personal day for that, I will dock you. So the only day that I could move things in was Columbus Day, which was a day off school, and the floors hadn't been done.
Oh, no.
So it wasn't, but, and the principal lived on the street, so he knew what I was doing.
Oh.
But he didn't feel that a single woman should build a house by herself. So there were some...
Or move in her furniture, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
So I'm going to back you up a little bit and ask you about the correspondent. Like, what is a correspondence course?
Oh, you
because
do it by
so
mail.
Because it's so foreign today.
You do
so
it by mail.
So you do it by mail, meaning they send
you... Would get
you...
I got several booklets, but I would get a booklet of lesson plans. And you would... do your homework, and you would do your lesson plans. You would send it back to Chicago. One of the teachers there would critique it and send it back to you.
And it by putting notes on the pages.
It was done that way. Now we do it by email, but this was done. I did the interior decorating first, and then I did a bookkeeping course because I thought that would come in handy. Which wound up being very handy because I've been treasurer or auditor of many organizations over the years. But it was a way, I was teaching, and so there wasn't any way that I could take the summer off to go do this. I had taken 4 summers off to get my master's degree at the University of Connecticut, because at that time, Connecticut state law said you had to have your master's degree between 5 and 10 years of being hired.
Oh, okay.
And when I started at Salisbury Central, Mr. Sullivan said, you go right back to school. You're in the pattern. Mm-hmm. If you wait, you'll procrastinate, which was excellent advice.
Now, was he the principal? I understand you were the first to receive a sabbatical to go out of the country.
Oh, yes. Well, that was several principals later. We had several different ones. I had been teaching, let me see, 67, about 15 years. And I was getting just a little jaded. And my husband and I were sitting on the couch one day. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to put in for a sabbatical. Well, his ears perked up. And in the back of my head, Foster was older than I, and he had been an able-bodied seaman in the 30s, and one of his trips to sea was to England, and he'd been in Swansea for a couple of days, and he loved England, and he wanted to go back and spend a year there. But he got married, he had 4 children, there was no way. His first wife died in 79, he married me in 82, and this was 86-ish. And I said, I think I'd like to go to the United Kingdom and study the British education system. Oh boy, says he, I'm gonna talk to Val Bernadone. Val Bernadone was the superintendent of schools at that time. And Foster McMillan and Val Bernardoni were in Rotary together. So Val said to Foster, have Jean make an appointment with me. Oh, I went over to his office at the high school and explained what I wanted to do. And he said, well, we're going to give you a list of questions to fill out. You have to write a program that the big board will pass. The big board being representatives from each school board of each of the six elementary schools and a representative from the high school.
Wow.
Well, I had said to Foster, I'm not going to get it. Number one, I'm not an administrator. Number two, I'm a woman. Number three, I want to go out of the country. There is no way they're going to give this to me. Other members of Region 1 had gotten sabbaticals, but A, they were all men. B, they were all administrators. C, they were all in the country. Lo and behold, I got it. I could go on half salary. I had to write a report, and I had to bring back enough slides to do six slideshows of 30 slides. Oh. Well, I answered all of the seven questions, you know, how are you going to benefit from this sabbatical? How are you going to relate this to your classroom and things like that? Well, we went over in August, no, we went over in June of 67. This is my report, 183 pages.
Oh my gosh.
Well, Foster had seen in the New York Times an ad from Florida State that they were running a continuing education course at Christ Church in Oxford, England. And in that time, I was in the process of acquiring continuing education courses. I had to have 90 credits of continuing education in order to maintain my Connecticut license. So he thought that was a good idea. I thought it was a good idea. So we went over mid-June and took courses at Christ Church in Oxford. Christ Church is called the House. It was started by Cardinal Wolsey back in the 1500s. And it was, for us, it was 3 weeks of board and room to get used to the English money, the English weather, and the time frame. Foster took a course called Medieval England. I took a course called the English Collection. I had taken college courses before, but the way this was set up was entirely different from anything I'd been in before, as the same with Foster. When we went over, I had a couple of letters of introduction to two women that I didn't know. We had an apartment. We had a flat in Stow-on-the-Wold. We'd gotten that for August. That's all we had.
And where was that?
Stow-on-the-Wold is in the Cotswolds of England.
Oh, nice.
Stow-on-the-Wold, where the devil caught cold. It is one of the more picturesque areas of England, in the south of England. So we did our courses. And then we got on the train at Oxford, and we went to Kingham, which was a village near Stow, and got a taxi and went to Stow-on-the-Wold to our flat, which was Cole. We were in all three of them, but Windrush was the one we were in most of the time. We had no transportation. You'd have to take the local bus to get anywhere. We took the bus and up to Cheltenham, which was the biggest city in the area, about 20 miles away, and we bought a car. We had to have transportation, and Foster loved to drive. I don't. And we left Stowe in beginning of September, and we toured various places, September and October, came back in October. I did my schools from November until March, when all of the tourist sites were closed. I did 26 different schools from Gloucestershire and Oxfordshire primarily. I watched 65 teachers teach, and I wrote a précis of every one of them.
Wow.
I saw some of the best teachers and some of the worst teachers. I would go into a school and I would meet with the principal or the head teacher, and I had a little questionnaire. And then they would assign me to a teacher, and I could either critique the lesson, be an aide, observe only, or have the kids ask me 20 questions. Well, I didn't know how to start this because I don't know anybody. I don't have any letters of introduction to anybody. I'm not an administrator. So I went to my tutor, Jill Solway, and she said, well, I've got a friend in the village that's a teacher. Why don't you and Foster come for dinner, and Tanya and Steve will come, and you'll work something out. Fine. So we went to Jill and Peter's house and had dinner, and of course Foster's eating English style, and he says to Jill's
English style meaning what?
Eating with the left hand.
Ah.
He said to Jill's two boys, Oliver and Bennett, you see, somebody knows how to eat properly because I'm eating American style, where you change your knife and fork back and forth. And so the first school that I went to was in Dry Sanford. And Tanya taught infants. Infants are from age 4 to 7. That is not my level. And I come to her classroom, and she introduces me to the class, and she says, now, Mrs. McMillan is going to take this group of 6, 4, and 5-year-olds and teach them English money.
Wow.
Well, I knew the money, but I pretended I didn't. And a 50p coin is octagonal. It's big. A 10p looks like our dime. A 5p looks like our nickel. A pence or a p is like a penny. Well, I messed it up. And Tanya came over after about 20 minutes. Oh, this American miss doesn't know her money. And Tanya went, oh. I said, it's okay. Having been a teacher for 15 years, they learned more by correcting me than if I was trying to teach them. And I went to her head administrator and gave him the questionnaire. He says, you know, he says, I've got a friend that's got a different school and such and such. Would you go there? I said, sure, I'll go anywhere. So he made an appointment. And that's how I got into the 26 different schools. I got passed around like a hot potato. But if I'd been important, or an administrator, I would have been able to see only the top schools.
I see.
I got into a Catholic school. Most of the schools over there are state religions, C of E, Church of England. I got into a school that specialized in travelers, gypsies, very different. I got into a school that was closing. There is no way, if I were an administrator, I would get into a school that was closing. So it was a more varied experience than if I'd been important, because I was passed around. I did infants. I did juniors are from 8 to 11, and then they take a test to see if they're going on to high school or whether they're going to go to a trade school. So I did college level courses for myself. I did elementary education, and I did 2 high schools. And I was able to get into a teacher's college.
Wow.
So I did the gamut from 4 years to adults and beyond.
Wow.
So I covered the territory pretty well. I came back with not enough slides for 6 shows. I came back with about 2,000 slides because I was supposed to be a resource person for the district K through 12. So I had everything. You name it, I had it.
Wow.
From spotted hogs to Goonhilly, which was the communication center for Europe. I had a little bit of everything.
So it was valuable for
our
community that you went as well.
Yes. And when we got back, I did garden clubs, we did church groups, we did the Rotary Club, I did some schools, I did some of the private schools. You know, medieval England, that sort of thing. Romans up the wazoo. Every kind of mine you can imagine, from coal mines to gold mines. And it was, from my point of view, it was the most valuable experience that I could ever have had. And I bless the ground that Val Bernardoni walks on, because it wasn't until I did his oral history that I realized why he saw the value of it, because of his background, because my principal was against it. He was not the least bit pleased. That's fine.
Interesting.
But I went.
Yeah. So Val Bernardoni's oral history is available on
Salisbury
Association. Yeah. That would be interesting to listen to.
Well, he was first selectman in town, too. And I have, with bits and pieces, I have something on all of the first selectmen in town from 1922 to 2023.
No kidding. So did you ever interview, I know you did interview at least one of your students, one of the Harney boys.
Oh, yes. I've done 4 on the town crew. I have done probably with the veterans, the town crew. I probably have done maybe 15 to 20 of my former pupils. They were available. They wouldn't dare say no to Miss Porter or Mrs. McMillan. And they've all done wonderful things for the community. Every one of them. Whether they were academic or not, that wasn't the point. They've given back, which is what I've tried to do.
Yeah. You certainly have. This will be your 10th year, I believe, as town historian.
Yes. Yes.
I've learned so many stories from you. Visits to you personally, visits to your office. And there's one story I actually don't know. Someone asked me about it the other day, and I said, I don't know. I'm going to ask Jean. What is the story behind Tory Hill? How did it get that name? Was it like a hill of Tories during the Revolution?
Tory Hill.
Oh.
And I'm reading this from an extract. In the biography written by Malcolm Day Rudd, when A.B. Landon died, he told the story of the Tory Hill farm property, which had been in the Landon family since 1751, when the tract of land was granted to James Landon by George III of England. When the revolution commenced, Captain James and his son, a second Captain James, was labeled, quote, Tory, unquote, for siding with the mother country, and suffered humiliation and financial loss in consequence. To avoid actual confiscation of their lands, they appeared to have transferred their land to their neighbors, the Bissells, who were, quote, Whigs, unquote, in the hope of repossessing them when the war was over. In this, these two Landons were disappointed, but Ashbel Landon of the next generation succeeded where they had failed and passed it on to his son James, nearly all of the real estate which the family had originally owned, which was 7,000 acres. The property stayed in the Landon family until it was sold by Mrs. Albert B. Landon to Clarence A. Seymour in May of 1943. And the house that Foster and I lived in was built on 2 acres of the Tory Hill farm property because the son, George Seymour, wanted his own house. But that's why it's called Tory Hill.
Very interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A great story. So being town historian, you began to be town historian 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves a lot more than I knew, including keeping up 5 town-owned cemeteries.
That was something, the job description includes preserving and interpreting the history of Salisbury and educating people concerning the materials available. And I have tried to do that. Work closely with the library director and staff. When assisting researchers, be available with the material that they want, but stay there. It doesn't get circulated. It's not necessary to have a working scholarship, but you should be on call 24/7 practically.
Wow.
Yep. Answer letters and emails regarding genealogy or town history. And I get them from the town clerk's office, the library, individuals on my computer, the office computer, my home phone, the office phone. Keep good records of all gifts received. Now, part of the job is to do an annual inspection of town cemeteries, 13, and report back to the town with recommendations. The previous town historian did not choose to do that. I felt it was important because of my connection with the Daughters of the American Revolution and also for genealogical records. And there are 13, when originally there were 14, because Connecticut state law indicated that you had to have as many cemeteries as school districts. We had 14 school districts, so we had 14 cemeteries. There are 5 town-owned, and the others are privately owned. But I inspect them all, and I make recommendations either to the association that is taking care of the cemetery or the landowner that owns the property. And with that, you are responsible for tree limbing, boundaries, whether they are wooden boundaries or iron and granite fence boundaries, restoring the stones. I have a wonderful company out of Norfolk, Monument Conservation Consortium. I have a fellow that's a professional stone cleaner, Bruce Valentine from Millerton, New York, that cleans stones professionally the way they should be done. And we all work together. I have some people that take care of a cemetery, a small cemetery, that they have done since Lila Nash was the town clerk. And he's probably in his 90s now. And I call him up in September and say, do you need any help? No, I'm fine. And then I call him up in April or May whenever I do the inspection and say, you've done a wonderful job, Mr. Holstrad. Thank you so much. The oldest cemetery is the old burying ground. And the reason it's called a burying ground is because it is connected or was connected with a church. The site of the town hall back in the 1740s was a church. Uh-huh. It was used as a church, a meeting house. And the land behind it was the burial ground. Salisbury Cemetery, Mount Riga Cemetery, Chapinville Cemetery are called cemeteries because they don't have a land connection with a church.
Oh, interesting.
They're separate from. Yeah. Now, St. Mary's Cemetery is unusual because when the father came to establish St. Mary's Church in 1873, he bought the land for the church and the land for the cemetery. And that's a private cemetery. I work with Jack and Kathy Hawley. They're the ones that do all of the maintenance and this, that, and the other thing. But I inspect the cemetery and I call them up and I see, is there anything that we can do of the town to help? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we work together. The second oldest cemetery is in the middle of Hotchkiss campus. It's very hard to find.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yes.
I love that little cemetery.
Town Hill.
That's the second oldest.
That's the second oldest. Huh. And the reason it's called Town Hill is because that's where the town was supposed to be.
No kidding.
It was supposed
to be. On top of the hill?
Yes. It was supposed to be on top of the hill with the views looking over the lake.
Right, right, right.
And it was... I understand from my latest intern that the Hotchkiss students get teased about having a cemetery in the middle of their campus. The cemetery was first. The campus didn't come until about 1890. And that is unusual because the boundary is made up of granite pillars that cost $1,600 to replace.
Wow.
And the iron railings were axles from the Salisbury Iron Works that was on the outlet of Lake Winnanskapamuck.
Wow.
So, that, you know, there's a lot of history with this. And I have to give John Bryant and Andy Fenn from Hotchkiss full marks for doing a magnificent job of bringing the cemetery up to speed. Meaning? When I took over, it was in, I'm going to say neglected state. And I really wanted them to focus on bringing it up to show status. So I went to John Bryant, who is head of buildings and grounds, and I said, come with me, look at the cemetery. And we went out, and the rails are falling down, and some of the pillars are broken, and the trees are kind of over the cemetery. And the stones are wee-wah. And I said, you know, you've got a lot of students that come from China and Japan and the Asian countries. And in their culture, they venerate their ancestors. What kind of PR do you think this cemetery is putting out? Oh, he says, I never thought of that. And when I first took over, I would send emails to the sextant at the time, no answer. Now we have our meeting. What do you want, Jane? They're wonderful. They're wonderful. And they've done a tremendous job. As all of the associations that I work with and all of the individuals that I work with, we're a team. We work together. They get high marks for their effort, and they get fulsome praise from me.
And how did you come to be town historian?
I got suckered into it by Catherine Shilko. I had worked with Catherine as her aide or volunteer, and she wanted to retire when she was getting older, but she was very concerned about the records being pinched, because the way the library is set up now, you can come into the main library lobby, but there isn't anybody that sees if you're going up to the history room, and it was not locked. And Catherine was very upset about that. She said, I'm not even sleeping nights. Well, I like Catherine ever so much. We worked together. She was school secretary almost all the time I was there. And I just couldn't let that happen. So I sent in my resume, and I was interviewed by the three selectmen, and they decided that it would be okay for me to take over. And with the new director, Karen Goodsell, I approached her about this problem, and we decided that the history room could be locked when I wasn't there, which makes me feel better.
Yeah.
And it's a safety precaution, and I think it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Yeah, because these are records, and history is without duplication. Most of them, if you lost them, that's it. They're gone.
Well, this is why I got a bee in my bonnet about 4 years ago to have some of the records digitized, which was an experience. And so now, at this point, all of the oral histories have been digitized and are on the web. And all of the 65 memoirs that we have been digitized.
The 65 memoirs?
They would be first-person accounts, as for example, Jane Tuttle worked at the Scoville Library for years, and she gave me a memoir of working at the Scoville Memorial Library. Or Rosemary Fidali gave a memoir of working on the first squad of the EMTs.
Oh, wow.
So we've got...
And so you've digitized those?
Yes. They are not on the web, but they are digitized. I've got the thumb drive to prove it.
So they're protected?
They're protected. They're protected.
Yeah. Oh, that's...
So I'm doing what I can to preserve the history of the town.
Well, the town is very grateful. And I'm very grateful.
Well, the town has been good to me. They've been very good to me.
Well, speaking of having once been a newcomer to the town, do you have any thoughts or advice for new people moving to town?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. As Jean puts a stack of books on her lap.
Well, the first thing I would say, and again, another anecdote, when we moved to Great Barrington in 1955, my father was not a reader. He'd read the newspaper, but he was not a reader. And he went to the Mason Library and took out a thick book, The History of Great Barrington, and he read it cover to cover. And that impressed me a lot. So I would say to people that move into town, please get involved with the town, but read the town history so you know how it's worked in the past. I know that a new broom sweeps clean, but it's always been my policy to shut my mouth and open my ears to see how it's been done before I want to change anything. We had an unofficial town historian, Malcolm Day Rudd, who published a book, Men of Worth of Salisbury Birth. It talks about the movers and shakers of Salisbury back in the early days, and it's an interesting book to read. Ginny Moskowitz was the next historian. She didn't write a book, but she was followed by Norm Sills, and he wrote The History of Salisbury, From Primitive Frontier to Flourishing Town. And it's very comprehensive and very well done. Then Catherine Chilcote took over, and she wrote Highlights in the History of Salisbury, Connecticut, 1700 to 2000, some known and some little known facts. And then I had to get into the act with Salisbury Town Tidbits, and this is a compilation of small essays written about how things started, such as the Scoville Memorial Library or the fire department, Dr. Knight's School for Imbeciles, and various things. Again, it was an attempt of PR to get people interested in town history. Then we have Julia Petit and her book, Reverend Jonathan Lee and the 18th Century Township of Salisbury, Connecticut. She documented this up the wazoo. More footnotes than you'd ever want to know, but it's well written. She was a librarian at Vassar College for years and knew what she was doing. We have A Short History of Salisbury, Connecticut by Arnold Whitridge. We have the Journal of Judge Warner, who was a pillar and shaker in town, and he talks about a lot of the things that were going on in the town. He wrote this in 1926, primarily for his kids. And then if you're interested in the Revolutionary War, the DAR chapter that was in town was called the Arsenal, because we were the Arsenal of the Revolution. And this was edited and written by Ed Fales Jr. They're almost all of them available at the Salisbury Association, so learn to work with the town and read about the town history.
Thank you very much for your wonderful book recommendations. And these are all available for sale at the Salisbury Association,
yes.
I understand. And they're probably, are they at the library as well? Oh, maybe not.
No.
Yeah. So these are secret volumes that can be found in the Salisbury Association.
I wouldn't say secret, because we do try to promote the town history, but they are at the Salisbury Association.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
You're welcome.
So I wonder if there's anything that I haven't asked you that you might want to share with people?
I think we've covered it pretty well.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for your time. It's been a very illuminating chat. I really appreciate it.
I've been very garrulous. Thank you.
Been very informative. Thank you.